Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of the environment, health, food, policy, and the media. And each week on Connect the Dots, which is now in its ninth year, we connect the dots between what we are experiencing as individuals, as communities, as regions, as a society, and as an interconnected, global planet, both on social, political, economic, as well as environmental levels. And so each week on the show, we bring on different authors, thought leaders, scientists, advocates, activists, filmmakers, and on, journalists. We've had a lot of journalists on the show, economists, and that's what we do each week on the show to discuss specific facets of our interconnected world. I'm extremely excited about today's show, as many longtime listeners will understand as we begin to unpack what we're talking about today. We're going to be featuring a book, and one of the two authors is with us to discuss it. His name is Danny Haifong. He's a socialist activist, writer, and political analyst. And for the last 5 years, he's been a weekly contributor to Black Agenda Report. His articles have also appeared in publications such as Mint Press News, Counterpunch, and international publications as well. And he's also been on many radio programs. We're here today to discuss his new book, written with co-author Roberto Servent. The book is called American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News, From the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. You can see what a rich and important topic this is, and so I'm delighted to welcome you, Danny Haifong, to Connect the Dots. Thanks for being with us.
I really am happy to be here, Allison.
You know, one of the things, when I began reading this book, I actually had a lot of trouble putting it down, so to speak, because, you're setting up a framework which, is really the one we need to be looking at. Because, if we look at the problems that we notice episodically, the I Ching, which is, I regard as an indispensable kind of eternal text of wisdom, says that if we look out of the gate through a narrow crack, we won't really see our people, we won't really see reality. And that someone who is living in a heroic time and must step up and do heroic things can't afford to just look at one tiny little piece, this is the thing I'm interested in. We really need to get a sense and an orientation to looking at the whole picture in its many facets, and that's really what you're providing here. Basically, something I railed about constantly is that the media is supplying us with beliefs and attitudes about what is going on in our world. And if we subscribe to that and blindly accept it, we're basically way off base and don't even know it because we're listening and taking in what's being sold to us. And American Exceptionalism, American Innocence, your book, just does an amazing job of deconstructing that, and I highly, highly recommend it. I'll also briefly mention that as this show airs, there's a public event happening tonight in New York at the People's Forum with Danny Haifong and his co-author, where people can come and learn more about the book, and we'll be talking more about the specific details of that later in the show. But let's begin with unpacking for our listeners what you mean by American exceptionalism and American innocence.
Sure, Allison. Well, what we really mean by those two terms are that these are ideologies which, one, presume the United States to be a force for good in the world, and which presume that the United States is a force for progress and one that is the most advanced political, economic, military, social system that has existed from this point in history. And And we define American innocence as a companion to American exceptionalism, where whatever the dictates of the mythologies of American exceptionalism are challenged, the American innocence weapon kicks in, whereby the United States is thus framed as more so as making mistakes or as having good intentions, regardless of whatever crimes or whatever wrongdoings happens to occur when the United States supposedly follows its principles and then gets exposed for violating them. We look at these ideologies really more complexly because how we envision them is that they not only kind of write the narrative of how many people in the United States see its homeland, its so-called mother country, but we also say that these ideologies more so frame how we act and how many people in the United States, even on the left, are influenced to devise their struggles around a mission to civilize and a mission to follow the white supremacist and imperialist dictates of the United States through this mythological notion that progress and reform can really occur under conditions that are laid out to it, that are laid out by the system at large.
So, in other words, we Americans have been taught to think of ourselves as unique, a great gift to the world, and only having the very best possible intentions. If, you know, in fact, we're seeing evidence and more of it, as we're speaking this week with the concentration camps where people are, migrant people are being detained and sent to, with children separated from their families, all of this kind of cruelty is, people are like, this can't be America. This is not the country. This is not who we are and what we stand for. And I think that sense, any sense of wake up around that and action and fierce action is certainly called for. At the same time, we've held this ideal about who we are, this is a further degeneration of, what we have been about in many ways, but many people are kind of disconnected from that history and believe ourselves, to be innocent about it. Why is that, in your view, an obstacle to getting a handle on the real problem and addressing it?
Because American exceptionalism, what it does is it basically lays the groundwork for how even the most well-intentioned individuals, organizations act in the world. It basically, what it does is, because the underlying assumption is that the United States is an exceptional country, is based on these values of freedom, democracy, liberty, so on and so forth, that even when those values are called into question, the very issues that are being called into question in and of themselves become projects to make the United States an even more exceptional country. You mentioned, and this really does show why this book was written in the first place. You mentioned the issue of concentration camps and Ocasio-Cortez and others raising the treatment and the oppression of migrants trying to cross into the United States through the shared border with Mexico. And we wholeheartedly have a whole chapter on that, talking about this question of immigration and questioning borders and how borders are an example of colonialism, white supremacy, and how that is cloaked in the myth of exceptionalism. But when we frame things, and I would agree that the horrific conditions that face many migrants coming from Central America are akin to concentration camps, what unfortunately usually happens when that narrative is sparked is that there is an impetus, especially among liberals in the United States, and this is why this book is more geared toward liberals, toward leftists, toward those who are really looking for alternatives to the mainstream narrative, is that what happens is that there is this almost a knee-jerk reaction where concentration camps are seen as singular, where there's this almost that every issue, every horrific instance that we can find within the United States the social system is seen as singular and is seen as a project of reform, and they become single issues, and then they become disconnected from the larger picture. They become disconnected from the larger system. Margaret Kimberly in Black Agenda Report wrote last week that the United States is full of concentration camps, and they're called prisons. That the United States has the largest prison population in the world, 40% of which is filled with Black Americans, and that these concentration camps also need to be considered, especially when many, over 40% of those who are stuck in solitary confinement, which is a form of torture, are also Black Americans. So there are these connections that could be made, but they're usually not made, because when something horrific is outlined by liberals, it's within the context of making the United States a better place as it exists, rather than thinking about what are the interconnected issues that we need to really tackle in the relationships of solidarity that we need, both domestically and abroad, that can help transform this system into one that is actually socially just, rather than one that pretends to be.
Right, yeah. What is the, like, I'd like to hear a little bit more about your insights into, you know, what is inherently part of this whole border, national border, you know, sense of, you know, excessive fear and pride to control debate versus, you know, a kind of more free-flowing in the supposed tradition of people, you know, kind of coming back and forth. Like, what is the control and the need to control, which is obviously reaching, you know, a horrible nadir in under the current administration, but which was also begun and engendered in prior administrations. Like, what is that actually about, according to your perspective?
Right. In Chapter 20, we talk about how this is whole issue of immigration is really about colonialism. It's really about imperialism, and it's all about a divide in the debate between both the ruling class and those who, on the ground and within the general population, who take two sides of what we feel like are a limited coin, whereby some believe that a migrant should be able to come in here, come to the United States and work and live a good life, which we don't object to, but we think it's limited and kind of short-sighted based on the reality of the situation. And then there are others who take the nativist, racist, and wholeheartedly colonial ideology that those hordes of, as Trump calls them, rapists and criminals should not be allowed to come. We take the position that actually this debate really limits our ability to see who are the drivers of this policy, because multinational corporations exploit immigrant labor, especially coming from Central America, Mexico, et cetera, to make super profits. So some of there's a large section of that class that believe migration to be a good thing. But there's also a large section of the same class of people who believe that these immigrants need to be controlled and they need to be criminalized in order to continue that process of creating a low-wage labor force that's unable to fight and organize with it, with any sort of meaningful activity that can be that can make a real impact in the United States. So if we look at it this way, then we look at how U.S. foreign policy also shapes the necessity of people in Honduras. If we remember, Obama's administration overthrew the democratically elected government of Honduras in 2009. We can look at the long history of U.S. intervention in places like El Salvador and Guatemala and how those conditions ultimately necessitate the need for people to basically run north and flee the horrific conditions that exist in those countries. If we can look at all of these interrelated issues, then we can see that this issue is much more than just protecting the United States' supposed values of allowing immigrants to come. There's this very strange and odd comparison that a lot of, especially liberals, make, where they say that the United States was founded upon allowing immigrants to come into the United States because that's what the settlers were all about. That's who they were. They were so-called illegal immigrants. They were fleeing their persecution in the mother country of the British Empire, so on and so forth. And we find this very ridiculous because the original settlers were colonialists and they committed massive crimes against indigenous people and then spearheaded and became the leaders in the trade and enforced enslavement of Africans. So we take the position that the whole immigration debate needs to be broadened because there are times when this debate becomes about making citizens, right? And we have a broader definition of citizens, even though we believe that there should be no such thing as illegal immigrants. There should be no such thing as people who are deemed in and of themselves criminal. But there's also this narrative making people citizens of the United States, making them legitimate. And that in and of itself can be a problem when there are so-called citizens in the United States who are being treated and who are oppressed to a condition that is very similar, or if not worse, than those, than a whole section of immigrants who are seen as legal, who are seen as, there's a whole tiered system here in the United States. Whereby some immigrants are seen as necessary and useful to ensure that the U.S.'s foreign policy objectives are maintained. So that we can look at the huge migration from Cuba over the years, which is indicative of that. But also the fact that black people in the United States and many oppressed nationalities in the United States live in decrepit conditions and live in extreme poverty and live under the threat of police terror and mass incarceration, that these issues need to be connected, and they're not connected because there is this impetus to basically legitimate the system through each of these struggles. And as we see, nothing really gets better over the course of the years, especially since the Clinton era. This crisis of immigration, this policing of the border, this criminalization of the undocumented has only gotten worse and worse, leading to even more and more suffering for the people that are supposedly being defended by the movement to decriminalize and to reform the immigration system.
So what you, I'm hearing, you know, two things. One is, you know, there's, you're presenting a holistic picture of the entire pattern of behavior as it has gone back over the last 20 years or more. You're showing how it is reinforced by and reinforcing other systems. And so, you know, in this analysis, which is one that many Americans who lack a sense of history and are declining educational and, you know, kind of fact and test-oriented educational system are unaware of, and without seeing the whole picture, the context for all of this and its historical evolution or devolution to this point, instead people will become fixated on either Band-Aid solutions or on, you know, single individuals as being responsible for this. And so, you know, in effect, you're providing all of that for people who are interested, you know, which should be everybody who claims they're concerned about this. You know, the one thing that I also would love to hear you unpack is the term colonialism, because I don't think that, you know, I think that can never be unpacked enough. But I think, that, you know, not everyone has a real orientation to it, and the fact that it's not only in our history, but it's ongoing as a modus operandus, you know, as a way we act. So even though in the innocence you mentioned, we construct our actions differently, as more caring in practical fact without really being aware of how we've imbibed these attitudes. We are actually serving that and allowing it to perpetuate without even knowing we're doing it. So I'd love to hear you define colonialism for our listeners, and also any examples of where in your terrific ongoing analysis throughout the book of the media, where people buy into colonial concepts or are taught to think in colonial ways that they're unaware of.
Sure. Colonialism is the foundation of the United States. It is what the United States is founded upon. It is also what predated the formation of the United States when the first settlers, the so-called founding fathers, when they reached the shores of what used to be Turtle Island, and decided that they were going to chart an independent path for themselves through the usurpation of indigenous land and the enslavement of Africans. So colonialism in the context of the United States is what we feel is a more perfected form of colonialism from even its predecessors, the Spanish, the British, et cetera, whereby the settlers, the first colonialists of the colonies, the original colonies, were able to construct an entire society. Rather than remain a colonial system, it was able to construct an entire republic, a unified state that was undergirded by the principles of colonialism, displacement, in the name of democracy, as well as racialized terror in the name of liberty. And the use and the creation of a republic founded on white supremacy was very critical and remains very critical to the United States because, in effect, every single development, because this system has changed, it has reformed. That is really the project of American exceptionalism itself as an ideology. It's all about reform. It's all about change. It's all about the promise and the prospect of becoming a more perfect, a more perfect union. And what many people don't realize is that reform is not transformation. It's not revolution. It's not. It doesn't abolish or eliminate anything. Reform merely means taking another form. And that's what has happened over the history of the United States with the development of its economic system, capitalism, its overarching system, colonialism, and its transformation into an imperialist, a global imperialist system, whereby expansion not only meant creating a whole nation state across the east and west of the territory now known as the United States, but also expanding across the borders into South America, its so-called backyard, as outlined in the Monroe Doctrine, or through expanding into the African continent, as we see now with AFRICOM, the U.S. African Command, where the United States now has military bases and military personnel in nearly every African country. And we can see this also in the Middle East wars, which both parties now seem to want to talk about in some ways, whether it's Donald Trump's lip service to the war fatigue in the United States, where he talks about the trillions of dollars spent on wars in the Middle East, or whether it's the Democratic Party's lip service to maintaining U.S. security while at the same time preventing a full-scale war in that region. What we say is when we look at what is actually going down globally and domestically, that colonialism remains very much a part of what the United States does. And we saw this really starkly in 2011 when the United States collaborated with NATO to overthrow the government of Libya and Muammar Gaddafi, its leader. What we saw with the corporate media, and you may find this very interesting, is that the corporate media, CNN, MSNBC, they framed the invasion of Libya as overthrowing a dictator, right? So there's this whole dictator narrative, but a savage dictator that was raping and murdering his own people. We hear this now with Bashar al-Assad. We hear this with whatever nation that the United States doesn't like, there's always this figure that's created, this dangerous figure, which we say is very much akin to how black people in the United States have been framed, especially black men, dangerous, rapist, threat, that they're always out to basically steal what the settlers have fairly taken for themselves. But what happened in Libya was that not only was Muammar Gaddafi the savage dictator, but he also was arming his people, supposedly, not just with weapons, but with Viagra to rape and children, women and children. And this narrative was seen as one of the most definitive ones which justified the invasion of Libya, the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi, the illegal murder and assassination of Muammar Gaddafi, and then the vast support that the United States gave to NATO and the so-called rebels in that country to turn it into what it is now, which is a destabilized state, which does not have a functioning government, and which has created not only hundreds of thousands of deaths in that region, but also a migration crisis. So back to this issue of migration, whereby millions of people have been displaced in the North African and Middle East region because of the chaos and the terror that was created by that war. So this narrative of colonialism, this jingoism, this framing of people's deemed to be subhuman in order to justify the aims of the U.S. state is very much linked to how the settler colonialists envisioned their quest for freedom. It was always on the backs of those that they deemed subhuman, and that was Africans and indigenous people. But that has been expanded to include anyone who gets in the way or who needs to be subjected and needs to terror and needs to be dominated in order to achieve the interests of the ruling elite in this country, and which are now global elites that are really interested in profit first and foremost in whatever, whether that's hegemony, whether that's a domination of other countries, whether that's through chaos, which is what we see a lot now throughout the world. Those interests are primary, and colonialism and the ideologies of colonialism help to cement their abilities to achieve those interests.
Wow. Yeah. That's, and also the chaos that you describe, the migrations that are engendered, all of that is also destabilizing, you know, formerly civilized, you know, and sort of more sedate Western nations in Europe, where, and you know, or and elsewhere in the world, where we're now seeing the rise of the right wing in response to the destabilization created by migrations that were engendered by American policy, which is rife with these attitudes. And the irony also, I have to say, is particularly strong for me today of projecting out onto leaders and people of color the kind of horror, fear, label of rape, when we have today someone or yesterday, you know, Jeffrey Epstein, who ran a underage, you know, kind of sex slave ring that was, you know, for the servicing of American political leaders and CEOs who participated in his, in what he had organized. And it's been years that people have been trying to get him under the legal system, and he's recently been charged. But they've basically been predating on young underage girls. So here we have people, actually leaders running the country, whose values you're describing, these colonial and white supremacist and economically dominant and imperialist values, they are actually the ones enacting the accusation that is then projected onto, you know, foreign leaders, people of color, anyone who is inhabiting land where we want to instate the military, or where there are ecological resources that are extractive modes of production and support for the civilization require for our own use. So, you know, it's a pretty ugly picture. You know, let's also just touch back base with, you know, the term innocence. In the face of all of this, you know, how and why are Americans maintaining this innocence, dissociating from these realities, you know, refusing to look at history because they're distracted into hatred toward one or another public figure? You know, how has that happened? How have we produced a populace that is so compliant with this?
Well, I think it really starts with the fact that the United States' imperialist system has so many reasons to maintain this illusion of innocence, because there have been strong and valiant and heroic movements and heroic resistance struggles against the very mythologies of American exceptionalism, because those mythologies have really dire material consequences. So in the book, we really do try to hearken on the fact that especially the Black Liberation Movement, which the book is dedicated to, Black Agenda Report, and we feel, and we still feel, that there is no ability to talk about U.S. exceptionalism, American innocence, and all that it seeks to cloak and seeks to make invisible without talking about those who have always been, or at least have been, in many instances, at the forefront of exposing these myths and doing so in a way that seeks to transform society. And so we, really derive inspiration from people like Paul Robeson, Claudia Jones, the organizations of the Black Panther Party, and trying to understand that this need to cloak the United States, not only in myths of exceptionalism, but also myths of innocence, is all about ensuring that that resistance is kept at bay. So people in the United States, even what we see now, and this is why we wrote the book too, is that there is this groundswell. We felt that Occupy Wall Street, the Black Lives Matter movement, and now the growth of especially progressive young people, but just progressive people on a whole who are moving towards the direction of Bernie Sanders, that these developments are very positive, but at the same time, they are very constrained by these ideologies, especially because what we see even when these ideologies, these efforts, I mean, are undertaken, oftentimes they hit this critical moment. I think the convention last year was a critical moment. In 2016, during the election, during the Black Lives Matter movement, I think Colin Kaepernick was a critical moment where a movement could have went one in two directions, and we could have seen, and then we really were taught, well, what happened to that movement based on repression and based on certain avenues that sections of that movement took in Occupy Wall Street itself, with the contradictions inside of it, whereby there were some who were looking to remain independent and remain very critical of the entire system. And then there were others who were a little confused and were thinking, well, we need cops in this movement and we need to build a broadest-based coalition. And ultimately, those divisions led to it being vulnerable to state repression and a lack of organization that was exposed by that state repression and the Obama administration's calling for its destruction, and that basically happening through the FBI and the police. So all of this is to say is that there are a lot of these positive developments, but ultimately the lack of organization and the lack of discipline and the lack of an ability to see the United States itself as a project of imperialism, a project of capitalism and racism and white supremacy, really does hurt even our most progressive and radical movements seeking to address some of the most important issues and components of this system. And I think that really is why this myth of innocence is able to maintain itself, is because every time a movement sparks up, every time there is this hope that I think a lot of millions of people see in things like the Sanders phenomenon, what we have is, especially someone like Bernie Sanders, is someone who is willingly compliant with the very structures that are seeking to destroy him, and that this has a real deflating effect. I think at the convention when he pledged his utmost support for Hillary Clinton, that was really deflating at that moment. It did not create a a huge rebellion. And I think that's because many were hoping that he could ride in on the Democratic Party ticket, become the president, and then change the system from within. And what we saw was that at least those who were on the outside as observers and who were critical of Sanders from the beginning was that Sanders himself as an individual isn't going to do it, and that we need to drop this idea of individualism. We need to drop this idea that these structures that are so ingrained and entrenched and so servile to corporate power and imperial power, that they themselves will allow any such thing to occur where one individual can change it. And that's how it's going to be. We see this in Extinction Rebellion with the use of, I forget her name now, but the a little girl who's seen as the most inspiring aspect of this whole movement.
Greta Thunberg,
Rather than talking now, she's on magazines, these huge corporate magazines, and it's becoming fashionable to show, well, look at this individual who's so brave and heroic, and that's going to move the elites in the right direction. That's not how any of this works. How it works is that it always takes a mass of people. Even Bernie Sanders says this, and he's right. It takes a mass of people, a mass movement, to create
social change.
Yeah,
I completely agree with you. Yeah, I mean, from the very inception of Greta Thunberg, I've been saying exactly that, because, you know, what happens is that we become infatuated with some figure in the limelight. We forget whose limelight they're in and who controls mm-hmm. that limelight, a.k.a. the media. And then we, you know, place all our hopes on them. We express our love toward them. And, you know, yet do we continually act. You know, there's a lot of fantasizing around these leaders and a lot of invisibilizing of, you know, these imperialist agendas as kind of being bigger than what we can see. Love to hear your comments on the debates or, you know, or any of that.
Sure. Well, the debates really do provide a great example of why this book was written. And you talked about the military-industrial complex, and we felt that as we wrote this book, what really needed to be probably the biggest objective of the book was to ensure that an anti-war and anti-imperialist narrative was maintained throughout, and that unlike much of the left in the United States today, that the U.S.'s military dominance and its unending wars abroad are not invisibilized, because that is what has happened to the U.S. military state, which is really interesting given that the U.S. military state has only grown exponentially over the last three decades, and for very good reasons. But we can't even get to those reasons if we don't understand that it exists. And so the 2020 debate was really indicative of how the Democratic Party has become the war party. We call it in the book the Party of American Exceptionalism, that what Hillary Clinton's campaign 2016 did was to cement what had been a decades-long process of transforming the Democratic Party as the engine of American exceptionalism, as the engine of war, but also transforming the party into this beacon of diversity at the same time. And so we've had this development and phenomenon where the Democratic Party holds up itself as the force for progress, the force of American exceptionalism, through the notion of diversity and the idea that the Democratic Party is an integrationist party. I mean, it needs to paint itself as that, because the Democratic Party's base, political base, is dependent upon Black voters as well as other key sections of the United States, which it calls diverse, aka non-white, really. And we see how this played out in the debates, where the whole 2020 election, generally the primary for the Democratic Party, is about stopping Bernie Sanders. It's about ensuring that Bernie Sanders remains weak and he remains someone that they can neutralize when the time comes. And so that's an ongoing process. So the 2020, we saw how there's, first of all, 20 candidates, and that's very strategic. Many people see that as random or maybe desperate, but in my opinion, that's very strategic in ensuring that the DNC has the ability to use its new rules to ensure that Bernie Sanders can't get the nomination, mainly through what I think is ensuring that no one candidate is able to get the necessary delegates. And I think they're doing that out of desperation, out of the fact that they know that people like Biden and Kamala Harris cannot garner enough inspiration from the base to bring people out to vote. But it's really about neutralizing Bernie Sanders. And we saw this in the debate. And there was one question that really points to how not even Bernie Sanders is very flawed, but at the same time, at least vocal position on foreign policy is unable to even make it into the narrative. And it wasn't even able to make it into the debate in large part. So there was one question where they asked, what would you do about China? And Bernie Sanders wasn't even allowed to answer the question. He didn't answer the question. All of the other candidates, mainstream candidates, talked, and you know, they gave their spiel about, you know, some of them sidestepped, Kamala Harris sidestepped, everyone sidestepping. But at the end of the day, Sanders wasn't even given time to answer it because there was this strategic motivation among the candidates to ensure that he was marginalized. And so, in effect, in the debates, what we saw was a complete and utter loyalty to the dictates of empire building. And the Democratic Party has absolutely no interest, given how much and how many donations it receives from the military-industrial complex, how under control it is from the military-industrial complex, but also that it is in this real war right now to maintain a political war based in crisis, where it's trying to maintain this legitimacy through diversity with the people, but it also is struggling to differentiate itself from the Republican Party. So it uses the myth of diversity to ensure that it doesn't look like there actually is one party in the United States, and that's the war party. And that's really what we're facing right now, because we're facing the fact that both political parties have a very similar agenda, if not undifferentiated, when it comes to the major questions of war and peace, of policing, of economic inequality, et cetera. We can go down the line, but these major issues are all agreed upon. So the Democratic Party is having a much harder time trying to appeal to its base, not on those issues, but on issues that they think will, at the very least, get their base to vote much more than it did in 2016 when it lost the election. So that's how I saw the 2020 debate. It was a lot about celebrity. It was a lot about kind of playing the corporate media game, but a lot of it also was very strategic, and we need to pay attention to that, because I don't know how many times we had to hear during the debate that the United States is the greatest country in the world, and the myths of exceptionalism are there in order to ensure we don't look at any of that, because all of that is either supposed to be too complicated for us, or we're not too interested in it, but really that's what they're working behind the scenes. That's really the strategy, is to neutralize Sanders and ensure that the Democratic Party is the party of war and the ruling class. That's what the Democratic Party is fighting out right now.
Yeah, I completely concur with that. And also, even if you look all around different places, you know, are attempting to sort with out for people this distracting excess of meaningless candidates that are clouding this up and confusing people with a spurious choice that they are flattered into thinking they have. If you look at all the places where, you know, The Hill or this Inside Climate News or other operations are writing, you know, what's the difference between the candidates? Here is a highlight of their policy positions. And then they go through the positions, and they're all completely, kind of really minor domestic positions where there even are positions. So, any of this other major stuff is just basically excluded from the whole conversation because there are too many people chattering on about superficial things that, successfully distracting us with their personalities. to actually get to the major things that you're talking about. Now, I just want to mention here a little bit more about your event. And again, we're talking to Danny Haifeng, one of the two co-authors of American Exceptionalism and American Innocence. Danny and his co-author, Roberto Servent, will be speaking in New York tonight, Wednesday, July 10th at 6:30 p.m. For those who are interested, at the People's Forum. There'll be another guest joining them as well, an author of another book. The People's Forum is at 320 West 37th Street, New York, New York, 10018. And the book that we've been talking about today, and we're not at the end of the show, but I just wanted to kind of bring this in, once again, is American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. One additional thing that's kind of, I think, is important to point out, as you point out in the book, Donald Trump is not the individual who began pointing fingers and saying this is fake news. Actually, it was Hillary Clinton who first said that, which I noted at the time, and then he adopted it. And in effect, intentionally or unintentionally, this was a shared weapon that she brought into the national conversation. And so there are people, therefore, I find in the segment of the American consensus that I talk to, are very sort of solicitous, trying to be good soldiers and showing that, they don't follow fake news and, they're critical thinkers and they are, kind of vigilant about the outfits that they receive, news from. But, when we watch this whole election conducted as a, or nomination process conducted as a orchestrated media display, which it very clearly is, and when, we are, all of the things that you're talking about in the book, which are normalized, never discussed, never analyzed, never spoken by anyone in the mainstream media, and have therefore been defined as outside of our concern, it's really, we, the American people, are the recipients of the fake news unless, we go out of our way to abandon those, mainstream sources, leave them behind, and to go to other sources. So one of the things I'd like to ask you is, what other sources do you recommend? And another thing I'd like to ask you is, I believe people are actually addicted to these wrongheaded sources. They, for some reason, they're easy to get. They can't let go of them. They would feel too at a loss or in a chaotic state if they weren't, returning to them for a sense of reality over and over again. So I'd love to hear both your recommendations and also your analysis of how, major segments of the American people have become entrapped.
Yes. Well, my recommendations would be, one, because the book is dedicated to Black Agenda Report, I will say that Black Agenda Report is one of the most, if not the most important, independent media source that we have, given that it is rooted in the tradition of the Black left, but also it was really the only publication, and I'm sure there were supporters of Black Agenda Report and others doing work that were also assisting, but it was one of the few that was really able to critique the Obama administration in a way that was helpful to the left, and it was during a period when doing so had significant political consequences, which I believe it still does. And we see how that has really shaped since the Obama administration's reign. So in terms of other sources, there's great independent media work. I know the Progressive Radio Network, people like yourself and others have great programs. I would also say, media like Counterpunch, Truthout, those outlets are so important to ensure. There's also another outlet that I want to give a plug to, the Hampton Institute, a working class think tank that I think people should really check out. But what we've had actually, which I really want to emphasize because it is much more difficult for me if you asked me this even 8 years ago when I was even first becoming politicized on the left. It was much easier for me to kind of list off things, and I could even keep a large list of these media sources. But what I've noticed over the years during the Obama period and now into this whole crusade against fake news that the ruling class is waging is that not only have these sources become fewer and farther between in terms of their number, but also the politics of a lot of sources has shifted to the right in response to the fear that has been embedded in the political discourse in the United States through Russiagate, especially, that has been so damaging, and it has been led by the Democratic Party, the military-industrial complex, the U.S. intelligence apparatus. There has been a real war on us as progressives, as us as leftists, as us who do not ascribe to either political party or either of the bourgeois narratives, the ruling class narratives that exist in this country, that this crusade against fake news is not a progressive one, regardless of Alex Jones's and these types being put under the same umbrella as the left, regardless of the consequences they face. Really what this is all about, it's about squashing alternative narratives, and it's about pushing the left rightward, ensuring that there really is no unified left in this country, that there's no ability for a real working people's party, a real working class party to exist. And we've seen this with Black Agenda Report, things like Naked Capitalism, Counterpunch, being labeled as dupes of Russia by that shady, anonymous online publication, Proper Not. And that has led into real policy consequences where Facebook, Google, and major multinational corporations that really control our airwaves have basically conducted a communications war. They've change algorithms, they've ensured that our work is much more difficult to find for newcomers into this struggle. And so, you know, my analysis is that independent media really needs to be defended and supported at this time because the new manifestations of American exceptionalism through Russiagate, through a real demonization of Russia in order to achieve the objectives domestically and abroad of the U.S. imperialist state, have created new dangers for us and have made it so this surveillance apparatus that has swallowed us even prior to Russiagate is now being used to suppress content that the establishment finds dangerous. And so my suggestion is to not only find these sources, but also to defend them and to contribute to them and to really fight that part of the struggle, which we talk about in the book as being not only dangerous internationally for our, you know, for all of the machinations and provocations of this drive to war with Russia that the United States is on, but domestically, by calling every single leftist a dupe of Russia, we have been effectively silenced, and so we need to break through that silence.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, and I can also testify to what you're talking about because, you know, I began at the Huffington Post. For many years, I reported on fracking on Alternet, and I've watched both those outlets, which were low-paying to begin with, degrade. I now report here on Progressive Radio and on Truthout, and, you know, regularly tout Truthout, Common Dreams, Counterpunch, The Intercept, and other outlets, because, you know, they're remaining untainted in this whole episode. And, you know, briefly, because we only probably have another 3 minutes, but, you know, can you give us a kind of tiny capsule on just your view of Russiagate? Because I think it has been weaponized and then internalized by people who, you know, have come to believe it through media repetition. But, you know, it also was ostensibly providing a solution to our so-called problems, or to Trump as our problem, which, of course, he is a problem. He's a big problem. But it, you know, really hasn't been borne out. I mean, your view.
Yes, so my view, real briefly, one, I do think it is important to understand that the very evidentiary basis of the accusation has not been founded in fact, and that it remains a conspiracy theory that has been thoroughly debunked even by the so-called arbiters of this conspiracy, like Robert Mueller. So we do have to get into the details of what exactly the United States is accusing Russia of doing. But two, really, Russiagate was all about making a scapegoat out of Russia. And it's very ironic that Russiagate came at this time when Trump was elected, because Trump's election was really the fissure of American exceptionalism growing wider, where this myth of American exceptionalism was kind of debunked when Trump was elected. Nobody thought a celebrity billionaire who was openly racist could be elected in the greatest country in the world. So Russia was used as a way to scapegoat any sort of explanation as to why that happened, both in terms of the U.S. being a profoundly racist country, but also the fact that his opponent was so utterly horrific policy-wise that those who would traditionally vote for the Democratic Party either did not show up or decided to vote for Trump out of whatever misguided notions that they had. So all of this is to say is that Russiagate not only ensured that so many people would be unable to really analyze and understand the objective conditions which brought Trump into the White House, the inequality, the endless war, the white supremacy, all of those things that we talk about in the book, we can't see those if Russia is the enemy. But also we have to understand why Russia is being labeled the enemy. And it's being labeled the enemy because the United States really does have a longstanding, not only throughout the Cold War, but even post-Cold War, the United States has had a longstanding strategic objective of ensuring that Russia never became a great power again. And because the United States is kind of losing its grip over the direction of Russia's politics and its economy, it has intensified that war under Obama, and it continues under Trump, militarily encircling Russia and attempting to overthrow its government in many various ways. And so we have to understand the whole picture of Russiagate, and we do have to, you know, Aaron Maté, and there's so many, Stephen Cohen, there's so many real prominent journalists who did really great work on the evidentiary basis of it, but we also have to understand the political basis, why this is happening in the first
Thank
place.
You.
It's not random. So that would be my analysis.
Thank you. That's great. Yeah, I think that's very important and comes right out of your book. So we've been talking with Danny Haifong, the co-author of American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News, From the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. Listeners, I'm hoping and believing you can see from, you know, hearing this selection of, you know, this kind of comprehensive understanding and analysis, how important this is, this book is, as a kind of Bible and corrective to some of the misunderstandings to which we have been subject by, you know, media serving as a house organ in this fashion. Again, invited to tonight's book launch at the People's Forum, 320 West 37th Street, in New York, if you're in the area, begins at 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday, July 10th. Thank you so much, Danny Haifong, for being with us today and for your brilliant analysis. And, you know, good luck with the book. And, you know, we hope to have you back again another time here on the show. It's just been terrific.
I really appreciate it. And, yes, I look forward to being back as well.
All right, great. All right, listeners, we're signing off for today. We'll be back with the next edition of Connect the Dots next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. This is a lot to digest. It's called reality. Losing innocence doesn't feel good. Heads up, keep marching forward in the company of all our relations.